Hello, everybody.
Waka flocka!
Okay, this is just a test recording here.
Waka flocka!
Tide is saying waka flocka.
Waka flocka!
What's going on, everybody? This is Todd Golden here with my brother Matt Golden, and we are together for real, not digitally, in Matt's apartment in Madison, Wisconsin, and this is the With a Bullet podcast. Matt, I'm hugging you right now. It's so nice. What's going on?
Not too much. You guys just showed up. Your son Niall's here, too. You guys just showed up probably about an hour ago, and there's a old Brewers game on TV right now.
They just showed the 2005 Ricky Weeks and Prince Fielder just hit their first home runs, which means nothing to anybody outside of the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So, but I'm here on a brief visit of the home state to show my son, you know, where he was born up in Eau Claire and stuff like that. So it's been fun. Saw some family. We're going to head back to Indiana tomorrow, but, we were going to record this on, typically we record on Wednesday nights. We were going to record this one Tuesday because I was originally going to swing through here to go to Minnesota, but I scaled back the vacation and that changed when I was going to be here. So we're a little delayed on the podcast. That means we'll have one quicker next week. But
right.
So this was my pick, though, and I chose June 28th, 1975. Just figured we hadn't had I think we did one from early 76 early on.
Yeah, that was an albums chart.
Right, and we haven't really hit the singles from this period. It's an interesting period, I think. It's interesting for me, and I'll get into that in a second, but you see the embryonic early disco songs on this chart a little bit, but it was really before that became a thing. So, and you're also at the back end of the 70s, early 70s conceit of pop music. You see a little bit of that as well. For me, some of these songs were the first songs I remember hearing, period. I may have heard some of these songs later on in the 70s. Some of them probably at the time, though. So you're right around the time I would have been about to turn 4 years old when this chart would have been current. And so some of them were bubbling through, including one of your songs that I hated then and hate to this very day.
Oh, I'm kind of curious to see which one it is.
It's coming. But what I wanted to ask you, though, you were born in 78. I have a conception of the mid-70s because I was, quote-unquote, there. And I do remember it. I remember what it was like back then. You weren't born yet. What is your perception of that period of time? I'm curious.
Don't really have much of perception of it. I mean, aside from just like what was going on, like in sports and like Jimmy Carter being elected, which happened a year after this, and like the bicentennial was coming up, just kind of that type of stuff. But in terms of like pop culture, maybe some of the movies, like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest that year. So, I mean, mostly.
I think Jaws came out.
Jaws probably would have been out right around now, but don't really have that much of a feel of like.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was thinking like putting myself in your shoes to the same year that would have applied to me would have been 1968. And of course, that's an iconic year in American culture generally.
Yeah.
But it is interesting when you don't have any firsthand experience what your perception of it is. And certainly for us talking about music, 68 is pretty dramatically different from 75. It's amazing how the music evolved in such a short period of time.
Definitely,
then,
yeah.
Then, you know, that evolution has really slowed down over the years. But a lot of these songs were what my parents would have been listening to, not all of them, but a few of them. And so it's takes me back in that sense of sitting in a back seat of a car back in the mid-70s. So here's a mid-70s thing you didn't realize, like no seat belts.
Yeah.
I was just wandering around in my back seat. I don't know. I guess our sister Bridget would have been there by then, so I shoved her down the stairs at some point during this period.
That's true. I've only heard about that.
But. Yeah, we lived in a house. We lived in an upstairs duplex in 1975. It would have been in the middle of Milwaukee. And it was the second last place we lived in before we lived in the place before we briefly moved to Texas. So I definitely remember that place and that neighborhood. So these are some early memories for me. So for you, you're just a young little whippersnapper who was just a gleam in our dad's balls at that point.
Pretty much, yeah.
Anyway, let's get started. So for you, Matt, to begin things, number 40 is I'll Do Anything You Want Me To by Barry White.
I kind of mentioned in a previous episode when I had Barry White that all of his songs kind of sound the same, and that's the same for this one, so I'm just skipping it.
Okay.
But 39 for you is Charlie Rich with Every Time You Touch Me, I Get High.
That's right. Charlie Rich, the album cover of this is awesome. It's got one of those typical mid-70s country albums where it does show a really deep zoom of the artist. So Charlie Rich is in a white cowboy hat. He's got long blonde hair. So cowboy hat, long blonde hair. He's got sort of a cowboyish shirt on with studs in the collar, all the way down the collar. And he's got cigarette in mouth and a lit match in front of the cigarette. So very sensual from Charlie Rich.
Yes.
The song itself is Billy Sherrill, who was a big-time country producer, kind of mawkish song. But unlike a lot of country mawk, it doesn't have a lot of strings piled up on it. It's kind of spare. Mm-hmm. So it kind of works. It's okay. It's all right. It's not behind closed doors or anything like that. But the more important thing is that we were only a couple short months away from Charlie Rich burning John Denver's envelope at the Country Music Awards, an act which honestly kind of led to Charlie Rich's career downfall. He never really... He was probably drunk when he did it. He was doing it for humor. He actually had nothing against John Denver at all.
Yeah.
But people didn't take it that way. And Charlie Rich had a few country hits after that, but he was nowhere near what he was, because Behind Closed Doors and The Most Beautiful Girl would have come out within a year of this song. Mm-hmm. And he was hot. He was like the thing in country at the time, and he never really recovered from that stunt. So it's too bad, because some of his songs are pretty good.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't really as familiar with this one as, like,
well,
Behind Closed Doors.
Go look at the album cover
like
for
that.
This, and you'll get real familiar, because you'll be like, man, I want to get to know that guy. He's got a lit match. And the funny thing is, the match, it's like well more than half burned out already. So it's like he's been holding it there for a while to get this shot for the album cover, and it's about to burn his fingers on it. So, but anyway, for you, number 38, Spirit of the Boogie and Summer Madness by Kool and the Gang. We can't do a chart without Kool.
Yeah, I know. And Spirit of the Boogie is actually a sequel to Jungle Boogie, and the deep voice from Jungle Boogie, you know, the voice goes, yeah, come on, a boogie, like that. Well, it's back, and it's encouraging you to feel the funk and get down and
feel the spirit of the boogie, the spirit of the boogie.
And I found out that the guy who does that voice actually isn't in Kool and the Gang. He isn't a member of the band. It's a guy named Donald Boyce who co-wrote both of the songs. And the other song on this, the B-side, Summer Madness, is an instrumental from the album that came before this, and has really chilled out feel to it, kind of nice little groove with kind of Moog screeches all the way through it. And because of that Moog screech, it's kind of, we mentioned the Funky Worm in a previous episode, but this is kind of like the backup version of the Funky Worm. So it was used a lot in like the early 90s. It was sampled in 212 different songs. Summertime by DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, Snoop Dogg's Doggy Dog World, and so on. And also actually appeared in the movie Rocky.
Yeah, it's in a big part of Rocky. It's like one of the it's like the first ever Rocky montage. It's part of that where he's like training and stuff. Or he's actually I think it's where he's being reflective of whether he's up to all of this.
He's feeding his fish, actually. Yeah.
But they use the Moog part in that pretty prominently. So
right, and Kool and the gang didn't even know it was in the movie. So they all went out as a group to see the movie, and their song starts playing, and they all just went nuts. So I don't know.
In a more innocent time, where bands didn't care whether they were not getting royalties for it.
Who knows if they ever got like a cent off of that? But Summer Madness is the better of the two songs, but they're both pretty decent.
This is, you know, we've had a lot of '80s Kool and the Gang. '70s Kool and the Gang is actually really cool. I remember I bought just on a whim. I was like, okay, Jungle Boogie is a cool song. Hollywood Swinging is kind of cool. I'll go buy their '70s Best of just for the hell of it and see. This is the CD days. I was like, I'll check it out, and it's actually really good. I mean, they were a legitimate funk band, totally different from their '80s iteration, really. And at some point, they crossed over and wanted to be hit makers. So. It was interesting, but
yeah. See, but number 37 for you is Steely Dan with Black Friday, which I wish I had on my side. But
well, it's weird. I mean, it kind of gives me the opportunity to kind of note how weird it is that Steely Dan was a top 40 regular band in the 70s because there's nothing about what they recorded. I shouldn't say that. I mean, their songs have a catchiness to them in a weird, specific kind of way. But considering some of the fare that's on this chart and on the 70s charts that were their company in the top 40, it is bizarre that Steely Dan was, you know, pretty much a top 40 band from the, you know, 72 all the way through 1981. And, you know, it's, you know, because they're such a weird-ass, painfully intellectual, by this point, they were starting to become a painstaking band as well. So it's just strange, and musically this might be the weirdest top 40 out of all of them. I mean, Black Friday does not sound like typical Dan. It doesn't sound like late 70s kind of cleaned up jazzy Dan. It doesn't sound like early 70s guitar based Dan. This is in the middle and it's really dense and the subject matter is bizarre. It's basically about Jay Gould's effort to corner the gold market in the 1860s, and it's about cashing in before you get caught, you know, cornering the market.
I thought that it was about nuclear war.
No, it's about cornering the gold. You can probably apply it, that metaphor to that, but it's basically about getting yours before you get caught. And it's the lead song on the Katie Lied album, which is a great album.
Yeah,
but it is strange that there are songs on that album that could have been singles in their own right that never were, because I guess this is a weird period of Steely Dan too, because they were commercially successful, definitely critically successful, but they weren't what they were when Asia came out a couple years later, where they were pretty huge. So this is kind of, and they weren't as big as they were when Pretzel Logic and Can't Buy a Thrill had been out earlier in the decade. You know, they could have used Dr. Wu as a single, or if they really wanted to be twisted, they could have gone with Everyone's Gone to the Movies, which is about a pedophile inviting kids over to watch porno. So
I have heard that song on the radio before.
That is the most twisted song ever because it is catchy as hell.
Yeah.
And the whole chorus of the song turns on the parents of the kids, like, hey, the kids are all over at the movies. Let's go have sex. So that makes it, it's like Walter Becker couldn't have had a more twisted concept in the first place. And then he decided, oh, let's make it even more fucked up with the way the chorus works.
Yeah.
Which is part of the genius of Steely Dan, I suppose. But Black Friday is fine. It's not one of my favorite Steely Dan songs, but, and it doesn't fit really with much of anything else on this chart, but that's Steely Dan.
Yeah. Yeah.
So next up for you, Matt, is number 36 is Slippery When Wet by the Commodores.
Yep, and this is early funky Commodores. This was their second Top 40 hit, the first with vocals. Machine Gun came before this. That was an instrumental. This was their first R&B number one. Lionel Richie's on vocals here, and it's not typical Lionel Richie. He's kind of has like a funky inflection to his voice. And the song sounds a lot like Play That Funky Music by Wild Cherry, which came out a year after this. And I'm assuming Wild Cherry just like totally ripped off this song because it sounds exactly the same. And Thomas McCleary, who was the Commodores guitarist, wrote the song. He also wrote Brick House and Too Hot to Trot. And this is kind of in that same kind of mode. It was inspired by him seeing a Slippery When Wet road sign and thinking that it would make a good song title. And the song is about the perils of cheating. Basically, the Commodores warning guys, like, don't cheat because it's slippery when it's wet. So, but pretty decent song.
What if the sign they saw was Pass With Care?
probably would not have worked. Might have worked with the theme of the lyrics, but probably would have been a totally different song. I mean, you don't see Pass With Care as much.
Pass With Care. That was my Lionel Richie funk version. Yeah, Lionel Richie was different in the funk period of the Commodores. The funny one, it's actually a good song, is called I can't remember what it's called. Hold on. It was called Come Inside, where he's like a lover man, Lionel Richie. It's funny.
Oh, okay. So, yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, next one for you, and this is like total like shift in the opposite direction.
Garbage.
Roger Whittaker with The Last Farewell.
This is a hard skip. This song is ridiculous. I mean, it's like, I think it's about a ship or something like that. It's just the worst thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's awful.
I don't know. It was his only American hit, and it's best forgotten. So we'll move on to number 34, Bad Luck by Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes.
This was a reluctant skip.
Yeah, I like this song.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, actually it was between this and Slippery When Wet, and I just decided to go with Slippery When Wet. But it's a decent song, but I needed something to skip. So
fine, whatever.
But 33 for you is a big one here. The Bee Gees with Jive Talkin'.
Yep, this is literally where the Bee Gees revival begins, because this is its debut. This is Jive Talkin's debut in the top 40. So this is where the disco Bee Gees began, rarely to leave the top 40 at all until the dawn of the 80s. So this song was originally called Drive Talking. It was inspired by the causeway between Biscayne Bay and Miami, which is bizarre. But the Bee Gees were recording in Miami at the time, trying to get their groove back, so to speak. And, you know, from this point forward, they kind of, and this song is a good example of it, they kind of pioneered their synth bass sound that they had, that real bubbly, basically disco bass that they pioneered. And the way they did that was, is they used a synthesizer, Maurice Gibb used a synthesizer to overdub his bass lines to give it like that extra heft that Jive Talkin' has and several other Bee Gees songs from the 70s have. So they really, you know, in a way, they musically also kind of helped their revival by, you know, creating that disco thing that people could groove to. So it's a good song. Later, I was, you know, even though the movie came out over 2 years later, it was used in Saturday Night Fever. Although it's funny, when they made Saturday Night Fever, the actors danced to, I want to say they danced to Cool in the Gang or something like that. They didn't dance to the Bee Gees. That was like a late addition.
Right.
So, but anyway, this song starts the disco era for the Bee Gees, for better or worse, whether you like disco Bee Gees or not.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, iconic song. I don't like it as much as some of the other singles from Main Chorus, like Nights on Broadway, but it's decent. Actually, Fanny's like a little bit more.
That's a good album, man.
Yeah.
I mean, that's actually a really good album. But I mean, nobody cares what you think because Beavis and Butthead like this song. This was on Beavis and Butthead, and at a time when 90 or 70s nostalgia was coming into prominence, and they shook their asses to it.
Doesn't like Beavis like imitate the bass line too?
Yeah, I believe so. So worth checking out. You can now find, you know, YouTube, you can pretty much find anything now. So you can find all the Beavis and Butthead video breakdowns, which is really the only reason I watched that show.
Pretty much. Yeah.
We're like a tribute to Beavis and Butthead's video reviews, basically.
Pretty much. Yeah.
They were the trailblazers that led us to With a Bullet. Which is exactly what Mike Judge intended.
I've actually heard people like say that they are the best rock critics of the 90s.
I don't know if I go that far, but they were funny to watch. They captured the essence of some of those songs. I'll say that for them. Number 30. See, now I wish I had this song. Number 32 for you is The Rockford Files by Mike Post.
And I mentioned this in another episode because I did Mike Post's album as a long distance dedication, but I said that it was one of the best TV themes of all time, and I think I actually literally said that it was easily one of the top five. But anyway, I was thinking about it, and I decided to come up with a top five. So this is in no order. Rockford Files, Cheers, Taxi, MASH, and Barney Miller.
Okay. So my top five would be, and this is without doing any research, Rockford Files is my favorite because it rocks. I actually might put, Barney Miller would be in there for sure. That one's cool. I might put Hill Street Blues in there instead of Cheers. I might put either Good Times or the Jeffersons in there.
Mm-hmm.
And the Streets of San Francisco is in my top five.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
So those would be the ones I go with now, but that's without doing any research at all. I'm sure there's several I forgot.
Right. So,
actually Streets of San Francisco might still be my favorite one. I love that theme song.
It's pretty good. I mean, I didn't really watch many reruns of that show when I was growing up, so I wasn't really familiar with it. So
I watched it in the first run, so, you know.
Okay. But anyway.
That was when I knew it was my bedtime. Remember when you said last week, I think it was, that Hill Street Blues was a sign that
it was your bedtime? Yeah.
Streets of San Francisco theme a little earlier on was a sign that it was my bedtime.
Okay.
I think our mom watched that. I don't know that our dad did. That's a funny thing, too. Like, there's mom shows and there's dad shows, like when you're growing up.
Yeah.
For me, Streets of San Francisco, mom show. Rockford Files, dad show. Big time dad show. We love that show. That was and he had good taste on that. 60 Minutes, dad show. Little House on the Prairie, mom show.
Uh-huh.
And then there was a few that crossed over to both. But, you know, I'm sure if you name me a show, like Alice, probably a mom show.
Yeah, I remember mom watching reruns of that.
I don't, One Day at a Time, mom show.
Yeah.
Let's see, Hill Street Blues, dad show.
Was Quincy a mom show?
Quincy, mom show.
Okay.
Definitely.
Yeah, because I remember her watching that too.
I'm trying to think of a silly dad show. That he was like way devoted to from any era. Sex in the City, dad show. It was.
Yeah. I've never really understood that either. So.
I'm trying to think of what was the one Crime Story from the 80s, dad
show. Okay. Yeah.
That was a good show.
Of course, for him, the Star Treks, too.
Star Trek, dad show.
Yeah.
In Search of, Todd show. But right. Also a dad show.
Yeah.
So, it's fun. You probably have different ones than I do because you're younger, but... Yeah, but some of the ones from the at least the late 70s, I can make those distinctions.
Three's
Company, Mom Show.
Yeah.
Like, and there were certain nights, too, where, like I associate with networks. Monday night, CBS. Tuesday night, ABC. Wednesday night, I don't remember. Thursday night, later on, it
for
was
me,
NBC.
For me, it was NBC for that one, yeah.
Friday, I don't really remember. Saturday, probably CBS when I was younger. Sunday, definitely CBS.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, and football fed into that because we were an NFC household.
Yeah.
And so even on sports, like to this day, like you could go on YouTube and watch old NFL Today shows, which are I find interesting to watch. And we watched NFL. We were Green Bay Packer household or Dallas when we lived in Dallas, the Cowboys. So we were always watched the NFC. So it's still weird to me, like the old AFC broadcast, which we hardly ever watched, are still like strange to me.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that. I was kind of used to the NBC because we were, when I first started getting into football, we were living in Indianapolis.
Right.
They're an NBC team.
Well, and NBC, when I first started watching that stuff, was a complete garbage network. I mean, I think Rockford Files and maybe Chips, which was, that's a Todd show. Dad, our dad, he hated Chips because Chips was on the same time, I think, as 60 Minutes. And I always wanted to watch Chips, and he always wanted to watch 60 Minutes. So, admittedly, in hindsight, he probably had the better show.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, just kidding. But, so.
But anyway, this song has prominent Moog, prominent, like, harmonica solo, and it was different on the closing credits and the opening credits. Closing's a little bit quieter and harmonica solo's a little faster, but the theme changed every single season.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's like 10 different variations of this theme out there, and it won a Grammy for best instrumental and was one of 9 TV themes to actually make the Hot 100 in the 70s. And actually 2 of them went to number 1. SWAT and Welcome Back Cotter. So,
yeah.
But this one made it to the top 10. So,
well, I always like the guitar in it. And that's kind of, I don't really know what seasons had the harder guitar in the TV titles, but those are always, it's kind of like when I hear Let It Be on the radio, I'm always rooting for the album version, which has the harder guitar on it. And it's like whenever I watch Rockford Files reruns, I'm like, all right, give me the hard guitar on the credits. Because the thing about Rockford Files was, is you had to watch the credits because you had the phone message at the beginning, which was always really funny.
Yeah.
Or is funny. And so.
See, but anyway, let's move on to 31 here. Grand Funk, not Grand Funk Railroad with Bad Time.
This is a skip. I mean, as Grand Funk goes, it's actually one of their better songs, but it's still boring. So.
Okay.
Skip it. That leads us to number 30. This is a big one, and this is one of my early memory songs, Rhinestone Cowboy by Glen Campbell.
And this song is a lot better than its reputation. I mean,
It's a good song.
It is. I mean, I'm assuming people just slagged it because it was overplayed.
It was definitely overplayed. This might be one of the songs that actually introduced me to the concept of being overplayed.
Okay. But it's... The song is about a struggling musician in New York realizing that he has to make a lot of compromises to become a star. But he's willing to do it because he wants to be a rhinestone cowboy. It's basically about selling out. And
right.
It was written and originally performed by Larry Weiss. Campbell heard his version on the radio, and he was about to go on tour. So he bought a tape of the song and just decided to learn it while he was on tour, possibly going to record it. But he comes back to America from his tour. He went to Australia on the tour. And his A&R guy came up to him and said, "Hey, Glenn, you got to check out this Rhinestone Cowboy song." So kind of coincidence that happened. But he ended up performing it at a telethon, and it was a big hit because of his performance at the telethon. So the record company just decided to rush release it, and ended up kind of breaking Glenn out of a drought. This was his first top 40 single in 4 years,
yeah.
Which he had I mean, that doesn't seem like a big amount of time now, but he had released 13 singles in between then. But kind of reignited his career, and this was actually the first song since Jimmy Dean's Big Bad John to top the pop and country charts at the same time. So
it was a good song, but you're right in the respect that it was on the radio endlessly well into 1976, because I remember hearing it on the radio a lot. And so it was kind of a ubiquitous type presence, and probably because it had so much crossover appeal. Glenn Campbell made some interesting artistic decisions in the mid-70s. I mean, he had this, and later on he had a hit with Southern Nights, which is an Alan Toussaint song, which is, you know, you wouldn't expect Glenn Campbell to record with him.
Yeah.
Necessarily. So,
and Country Boy, which came in between, is almost like half disco too.
Right. So, so it was, you know, it was an interesting to probably in the end, long-term probably gained Glenn Campbell some artistic credibility, even though people may have gotten tired of it in the moment. So,
right. Yeah. But I think we're at your long
list. No, we're at yours.
Oh, okay. I thought you went first here, but...
Oh, no, you go first.
Okay. Okay. This needs a special intro, so here we go.
All right.
Are you ready, Steve?
Uh-huh.
Andy?
Yeah.
Mick?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, fellas, let's go! Okay, now that we have that out of the way, at number 80, we have Sweet with Ballroom Blitz. And this was 2 years after it was initially released as a standalone single in the UK. Capitol Sweet's U.S. record label decided to use it as opening track for their version of the band's Desolation Boulevard, which ended up being released in July of 75 over here. So that's why it's popping up on the chart in the middle of 1975 here. But it was written by Chin and Chapman, who were kind of the songwriting duo behind the band, and they've popped up a few times for other bands on some of our other episodes.
Sort of bubblegum England version.
Pretty much. Yeah, but they also wrote Little Willie, Blockbuster, and so on for the band. And the song was based on an incident where the band was actually bottled off the stage in Scotland. Presumably, a man in the back yelled, "Everybody attack," and it turned into a ballroom blitz.
I guess.
it's been covered numerous times. The Damn covered it with Lemmy from Motorhead on bass. Tia Carrere did it in the Wayne's World soundtrack. It was covered by the thrash band Nuclear Assault. And the intro's been spoofed a few times, too. My Chemical Romance did it. The did it, but they replaced the band members with Jesus, Buddha, and Mohammed.
Ooh.
And the line, "She thinks she's the passionate one," was sampled by the Beastie Boys on Hey Ladies. And it's just perfect dumb bubble glam.
Yeah, and what's interesting to me about Sweet is you touched on it, but Desolation Boulevard, which is the album it was on in America, was actually released in England, but in a completely different version. Actually, it was two albums. One of them was called, I believe, Desolation Boulevard. The other one was called, like, Sweet Fanny Brown or something like that.
Yeah.
They basically picked and choose the best of those two albums and put together an American version of Desolation Boulevard, which to British ears would probably sound more like a greatest hits. AC/DC did that a little bit with Dirty Deeds.
Yeah.
Too, later on.
High Voltage, they did that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But a lot of the songs on Desolation, like Fox on the Run, which came after this, the original version of Fox on the Run is not like the American version. It's a lot harder. Sweet was making a turn from being kind of a bubblegum glam band to trying to go more to like proto heavy metal by the time this stuff was out.
Yeah.
A lot of it was pretty good too, actually. So it's interesting. A lot of these songs that we've heard for years on Desolation Boulevard were heard completely differently in the UK when they were originally released. So,
right.
Ballroom Blitz, though, was always in this form, I'm pretty sure. But
yeah.
So, yeah, it's a cool song. It's not my favorite Sweet song, but it's, I think Sweet are underrated. I think they're kind of slugged off as either a bubblegum band because of Little Willie, or kind of a of-the-moment glam band in this period. But
yeah, I mean,
they're not bad at
decent
all.
Decent songs.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, also I have in my notes that without the, like, campy mad scientist voice of this, we probably wouldn't have Fred Schneider for the B-52s.
You know what? Here's what you could do if you're ever bored in the car. I do this once in a while.
Uh-huh.
Sing whatever song you hear on the radio or Spotify or whatever. Do it in Fred Schneider's voice. It doesn't matter what song it is. It could be any song at all. Just do it.
Okay.
All right, fellas. Let's go! And you can, like, on this song, and the band said attack! And then everyone, yeah, I got the lyrics screwed up, but you get the drift.
Yeah.
And it turned into a ballroom blitz. Ballroom blitz. See, it's fun.
Yes.
And I'm not making fun of, you know, it's actually fun to do that.
Yeah.
To use his voice inflections.
Oh, yeah.
So next time, that's my advice to anybody listening, is go all Fred Schneider if you're bored while driving.
Yeah. But anyway, I'd like to dedicate this to the man in the back and the girl in the corner. But moving on to 29 for you, Dwight Twilley Band with I'm on Fire.
This is a power pop classic.
It is.
And like a lot of power pop bands, Dwight Twilley Band didn't have a long-term success. His legacy is kind of for people who are in the cult and not much else, but the people who are in the cult, you and I being two people who are very devoted to people like this.
Yeah.
But the Dwight Twilley quote-unquote band wasn't really a band. It was just Dwight Twilley and his partner Phil Seymour, who worked together, and they kind of came through Memphis via Oklahoma. That's where Dwight Twilley is from originally. And recorded this song and a series of others. Eventually it became the I'm on Fire album, but it was not recorded all at the same time, but just very catchy, a little bit of Southern twang. They're closer to Big Star than they are to the Raspberries, if you're looking at this in the, you know, holy trinity of power pop bands. But very catchy stuff. I'll never forget one of my favorite times hearing this song. I landed in the airport in Charleston, South Carolina a couple years ago.
Uh-huh.
And for whatever reason, this song was playing at maximum volume as I walked through the airport.
Oh, nice.
It was cool.
Nice.
I mean, it was like, damn, all right, this is a nice welcome to South Carolina. But, you know, again, another example of a band that failed. Although Dwight Twilley did have another hit later in the 80s with Girls, which was just as out of nowhere as this song was in 75. But,
yeah,
you know, that's kind of the whole ethos of power pop. You know, a lot of bands that failed in their time that become revered later. The Raspberries, Big Star.
Yep.
The Flamin' Groovies, all of them.
Yeah.
I mean, there's very few power pop bands. Probably Cheap Trick, maybe, is one that became, like, actually super popular and maintained it to some degree.
Yeah.
That were true power pop. Now, I'm not counting, of course, the Beatles and the Who and the Kinks, who are the fountain of, you know, the source of power pop. But for the bands that came later, most of them had a very cult following in their time, and certainly the Dwight Twilley Band is no exception. So,
yeah.
Moving on, another big one, number 28, Philadelphia Freedom by Elton John. Or, I'm sorry, the Elton John Band, as Bill says.
Yes, and as far as I can tell, this is the only single that Elton put out that was credited to the Elton John Band. But anyway, this is a tribute to Billie Jean King. Elton and Billie Jean were friends. They met each other during the lead-up to the Battle of Sexes match with Bobby Riggs. And at the time, Billie Jean King was playing for the Philadelphia Freedoms in World Team Tennis. And when Elton recorded the song, she was on that team. And actually, he was drafted by the team and showed up to their matches in uniform. But by the time it was released and by the time this chart came out, King had been traded to the New York Sets. New York Mets, New York Jets, yeah, obviously tennis team, New York Sets. And the Philadelphia Freedoms had moved to Boston. They were bought by Bob Kraft, and they were renamed the Boston Lobsters. So obviously New York Sets and Boston Lobsters wouldn't work as well at a song. But it's kind of, well, a tribute to her and also a little bit tribute to Philly Soul with the sound of the song, obviously Philadelphia Philly Soul. And the bicentennial was a year, little bit over a year away, so a little bit of that gets thrown in there. And according to Bernie Taupin, the song has absolutely nothing to do with tennis. His direct quote is, "I can't write a song about tennis."
It'd be hard to write a song about tennis. Although you could include very... I'd hate to hear somebody try, because I know they'd work off of love somehow. Love 15, love 30, love 45...
Oh, yeah.
Why did tennis scoring become like that? That's so stupid.
I have no idea.
I remember our dad, when he was bigger into tennis, and when tennis in general was more popular in the late 70s, he'd watch it, and I'd be like, the hell does love 30 love mean? And he'd try to explain it, and it was like, right? I had no...
Yeah, I mean, the hell is that? I played tennis, and I don't really get how it was love.
I mean, I get it now, but I mean, I don't know how that even originated. Like, I've never even bothered to look that up.
Yeah, yeah, me neither. But anyway, this is, I mean, big hit, ended up going to number one. Kind of has like an early disco feel to it.
Very disco feel to it.
Yeah.
And this was another song, and probably because of the bicentennial, that I remember hearing a ton back then, too. So, of course, Elton John was kind of at the height of his powers at this point.
Oh, definitely.
He started
yeah.
to decline pretty quickly after this, but this was a big one.
Yep, big one for his band, the Elton John
Band. The Elton John Band. Maybe he was referring to the Muppets when he went on the Muppet Show.
Could be.
Maybe animals in the Elton John Band.
Right, yep. But anyway, let's go on to 27 here, which is Gwen McRae with Rockin' Chair.
Gwen McRae is the wife of George McRae, who had a hit a year before this with Rock Your Baby. And... both of these songs, both Rock Your Baby in particular, but also Rocking Chair, is very emblematic of TK Records style Miami disco. And Casey and the Sunshine's early songs sound like this too. They're very dense. I've always thought it sounded like the humidity of Miami and the tropics were coming through onto the record. Because there's a lot going on those records. Andrea True's More, More, More is like this too, because it was recorded or at least finished, I think, in Miami.
Yeah.
So there is, the disco gets lumped into one big lump sum, but there's a big difference between some disco songs and that Miami wing of disco. And I suppose the Bee Gees could be lumped into that too, because they recorded Main Course in Miami as well. I don't know how to place it. I don't know that there's a singular instrument that gives it that feel, but all those songs are just dense,
yeah,
in their groove and stuff like that. So, Rocket Chair is probably it has that aspect to it too, although it's more rooted in the early 70s. It sounds like it could be from 1971, like it could be by Betty Wright or somebody like that. But it's pretty cool. And George McRae, had several hits as well around this time. So this is kind of the height of Miami disco, which kind of faded out in favor of New Yorkish disco by the end of the decade. But but this was their time.
Yep.
Number 26 for you, Matt, is Baby That's Back At You by Smokey Robinson.
And this is from the Quiet Storm album, which kind of gave a whole subgenre of soul music its name. But it's almost a little too up-tempo to be considered Quiet Storm. has a lot of flutes and bongos on it, kind of jazzy. Probably a lot different from what most people in 1975 were expecting from a Smokey Robinson single. It almost reminds me a little bit of Spill the Wine by War. And also a little bit of Evil Woman by ELO in there too. But I also found a clip of Smokey performing the song on Soul Train, and this was when it was first being released. So he's kind of chatting up with Don Cornelius, and he's saying that he has his fingers crossed about this single. And Don says, "Well, I wouldn't worry about that if I were you, but but this was its peak, so maybe Smokey was right." But it did go to number one on the R&B charts. But it's pretty good song. I hadn't heard it before, but it's a decent song. So
I've never heard it ever.
Really?
Really? Is it as good as Being There? Being With You?
It's better than Being With You.
Is it better than Disco Duck?
Yeah, it's definitely better than Disco Duck.
Well, God damn it, that's the best song ever recorded.
Right.
I don't know what any of that meant.
Neither do I.
Okay.
But anyway, let's move on to number 25 here, which is John Denver with Thank God I'm a Country Boy.
I'm skipping it.
Boo.
Whatever.
Okay.
I had to skip something. I feel like this whole song is cliched. And when I went to research it, none of it grabbed me like as interesting. So fuck it.
Okay.
It's a very well-known, iconic song. It gets on my nerves too, so.
Okay.
It's fun to sing at a bar. That's about all I can say for it.
Okay.
That means next up for you is number 24, Why Can't We Be Friends by War.
Let's see, and this is softer and a little less Latin-inspired than most of War's singles. Has each member of War singing a line or two and then going into the chorus, "Why can't we be friends? Why can't we be friends?" And the song starts out with examples of how the singer or narrator isn't that much different from you and maybe you should be friends, but it loses the plot as the song goes along. And they start singing about how they'd like to be the president so they can tell you how your money's spent, or how they know you're working for the CIA because they wouldn't have you in the mafia.
Yes. Why can't we be friends? Why can't we be friends? They wouldn't have you in the mafia.
Yes. But it does have a video, which is kind of unusual for 1975. It opens with an Arab and Israeli playing chess, cowboy hugging an Indian, a guard shaking hands with a prisoner, a black guy slapping a Klan member at the back. And the rest of it is just like literal interpretations of the lyrics. It's pretty cheesy, but hardly anybody saw it because there wasn't MTV in the 70s.
This was the mid-70s, like the post-civil rights period, where people actually felt pretty good about where race relations were.
Yeah.
Sort of, anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, people were more optimistic, certainly, than they are right at this point, anyway.
Yeah. But let's see. It was played for the astronauts and cosmonauts at the same time, too, because there was the Apollo-Soyuz mission where they docked the two capsules together. So they played that to the crews when they got together up there. So
okay, so the Americans would have got that. What the hell would the Russians have gotten out of it?
Would have known that the U.S. was working for the mafia.
That's true. They already knew that, though. They've been told that already.
Right.
It's also extremely memorably used in one of the moments I laughed the most at The Simpsons.
Oh, yeah.
It was Homer Simpson's walk-in music when he boxed against an otherwise pretty weak episode.
Yeah, against like the Mike Tyson character
analog on The Simpsons. He walks in that. I watched that when it was originally on, and I just started pissing my pants laughing. I wasn't expecting that, but.
See, but this was also covered by Smash Mouth, and their version actually made the alternative charts.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, so, but anyway, let's move on to 23, which is Tony Camillo's Bazooka with Dynamite Part 1.
Dynamite! This is a big time, this is falls under cash-in on the popularity of something else, which would be Good Times, which, you know, was on TV at the time. It was big. Of course, Dynamite was Jimmy Walk, J.J. Evans' catchphrase, and that became a big problem on the show Good Times. Good Times was Norman Lear. I guess I don't know where it came in his timeline of shows. It would have come probably after Maude, definitely after All in the Family, and probably after, maybe with the Jeffersons. The Jeffersons, of course, were on All in the Family originally. So the show was originally supposed to be like, you know, a social commentary. It was comedy, but it was like All in the Family. It was supposed to have social commentary in it. Well, then when it became popular, it partly became popular because everybody thought J.J. Evans was funny with the kid Dynamite line that was in every show. And they taped it live in front of an audience, and everybody would go in that mid-70s Norman Lear show way. Everybody would freak out, which it is cool to watch that in reruns. But the problem was that wasn't really the intent of the show. And you know, some of the other cast members were pretty serious about the way they wanted the show to go in. And so the whole Dynamite thing became a problem. Eventually, it led to the departure of John Amos and briefly Florida Evans, her character anyway. She came back later.
But, yeah.
So that became a big, like, Jimmy Walker's popularity became a big problem. It was a blessing and a curse for that show.
Mm-hmm.
But my thing is that I think they missed an opportunity to do a song on Bookman.
Okay.
They could have done Do the Buffalo Butt.
Yeah, they could have.
And of course, Wilona, the neighbor who popped in, like kind of the Kramer of Good Times, she recorded the Jeffersons theme song, Janet DuBois.
Yeah, that's right.
So you had some musical. I was thinking about this today because I knew this song was going to be on it. I was like, you can measure America's mood on race relations based on Good Times characters. So in the mid-70s, we're in a J.J. Evans mode.
Yeah.
Right now, we're more like in a Michael Evans mode.
Yeah, you're right about that. You're right about that. Like, yeah.
People don't want to, like, civil rights and all that aren't, and I agree with it, aren't a laughing matter right this minute. In the mid-70s, people felt better about it, and people were laughing about it and stuff like that. So that's what I mean
right.
by that.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, next for you is number 22 is Hey You by Bachman Turner Overdrive.
This is the best BTO song.
Okay.
It contains elements of two of their previous hits. The intro is kind of ripping off Let It Ride. And the rest of it is based off of the choruses of You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet. And it's much better than both of those songs. And it's almost power pop, actually.
Yeah, I could see that.
And it's also a diss track. It's Randy Bachman was hitting back at his former Guess Who bandmates, specifically Burton Cummings. And Bachman's departure from the Guess Who was kind of acrimonious. He converted to Mormonism at the peak of their fame and kind of demanded that the band adopt a clean lifestyle, which didn't go over very well. And he explained that part of his demand wasn't like that he wanted them to be Mormons too. It's just that they were Canadian and they're touring in the US. And if any of them got busted with drugs, they'd have problems getting visas. But ended up splitting off from the band. He got into BTO. Actually, Neil Young had a hand in getting BTO together, which I didn't know about.
Yeah.
But Cummings was kind of taking shots at Bachman after he left. Said that he wasn't going to make it, called BTO Bachman Turner overweight. And by the time this came out,
BTO had a string of hits, including a number one with Ain't Seen Nothing Yet. And the Guess Who were kind of like falling down the ladder. This was when they were in like the clip for the Wolfman period.
Yeah.
So it was time for Randy Bachman to gloat about that. So
yeah, and then BTO would hardly have any hits either.
Exactly. And since that time period, Bachman's just kind of gone in like a cycle of feuding with Burton Cummings while being with BTO, then splitting with BTO, feuding with the guys at BTO, which two of the guys are his brothers, and getting back together with Burton Cummings as Guess Who, and then like splitting acrimoniously again and getting back together with BTO. But decent song, and obviously it went to number one in Canada.
I'm kind of a Let It Roll, Down the Highway guy, because I like the choruses, or the verses.
Yeah.
Rock. Although Hey You is a good song.
Yeah.
I don't ever need to hear Ain't Seen Nothing Yet as long as I live again. It's one of those, it file under not a bad song, but I've heard it way too often.
Let's see, and kind of doing the research for this, I kind of found out that Randy Bachman is kind of a huge jerk. It's Ain't Seen Nothing Yet, the stuttering part, he was actually like mocking one of his brothers who was in the band because his brother used to stutter.
Seems legit.
Yeah, so, but anyway, let's move on to 21 here, which is Melissa Manchester with Midnight Blue.
Well, this is one of my favorite ballads in rock and rolldom, and maybe my favorite overall. It's a song that you sort of have to apologize liking, because it is very maudlin, and you know, the arrangement is it's a torch song is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I've always loved this song, and I unapologetically love this song. She wrote it with Carol Beryl Sager about getting through rough patches in relationships. And the lyrics obviously reference that, about obviously the two people in the relationship had a fight, and but they want to just cool it off and let it basically sleep on it until the next day. I got to give a shout out to James Newton Howard, who played the electric piano on this song. And I think I'm a big fan of that instrument. That's probably why I like this song to some degree, but it really does set the tone. That the undertone of this song, you know, is there are string flourishes in it, but kind of in a muted mid-70s way. It's not like it's Paul Buckmaster like driving the whole song. It's part of the song. It's really just driven by Melissa Manchester's voice and just the tone of the song. It's from her self-titled first album, which that is definitely not in my wheelhouse of what I typically listen to, but I was curious because it has received good reviews over the years, and I went and listened to it. It's actually, as those kind of singer-songwriter albums go, it would probably be my go-to if I went to one of those. So so the actual album it's on is also pretty good. And Melissa Manchester would come back here periodically with other hits. Some of them, you know, that were like, you know, her last hit was very 80s with shit, now I can't remember what it was called. It came out in 82.
Oh, God. I forget what it's called, but yeah, it is very 80s.
But she was on the charts relatively consistently from about 75 to 82, but this is easily, I mean, it's her signature song and easily her best song, so.
Right. Actually, I think it was You Should Hear How She Talks About You.
Yes.
Yeah,
I like that song.
Yeah.
I couldn't think of it, but.
Yeah.
So. Don't Cry Out Loud is another big one. Now that one is a little over the top. Well, that came out in the late 70s, but
yeah.
So that leads to my long distance dedication, which
right.
I'm going to keep kind of brief this week, but I'm going to go to number 78 this week, which was Third Rate Romance by the Amazing Rhythm Aces, which is a story song. And I kind of want to dedicate this to story songs because story songs are fun. And this song, as I think, you know, there's a million songs written about one night stands, and there's a lot of good songs written about one night stands. I think this is the best song written about a one night stand because it's the most honest song about a one night stand.
Okay. Because it's funny. It's awkward. Mm-hmm. There's very little love involved in it at all, if any. It's all lust. And it's almost like a resigned version of lust. Like, oh, here we go again. Let's go check into the motel. And now you know the drill. You know, that kind of, that's the whole vibe of the song. So it's self-aware in the way it's written and very well written. And it's well played. Amazing Rhythm Aces were sort of a, they were a Texas band. And they weren't necessarily a country band. But this definitely has a country-ish vibe to it. Mm-hmm. And I always thought this song was really cool. And I actually went back, I went to listen to the album it came from, and they had a lot of interesting songs on it. So this was the only hit they really ever had. This would eventually make its way up into the top 20. But yeah, I like story songs. And I heard a great story song that I'd never heard before yesterday, actually driving around Wisconsin. From an earlier period, it was by Bobby Gentry, and it was called Casket Vignette.
Hmm.
And it was about picking out your colors and your, it was about a wife or a girlfriend picking out the colors and like the trimmings for a casket.
Huh.
And it was like told from the point of view of the salesman for the casket. And the salesman keeps making references to the fact that she doesn't seem very sad.
Okay.
Which she leaves open-ended to your own interpretation. And it was like, well, maybe she murdered him. Maybe she wanted him dead, you know, or something like that. So anyway, and of course, Bobby Gentry's more famous story song is Ode to Billy Joe, which is a great one. But story songs are great. You don't hear many story songs these days.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
You know, they were kind of dying out even in the mid-70s. But this one's a fun one. It's funny. Very true of what it's writing about, because most one night stands aren't really glorious. Most of them are regretted by the people after the fact. So
yeah,
it kind of captures that vibe. So let's move on then to number 20 for you is Misty by Ray Stevens.
This is a skip. This is actually a cover of the standard Misty. So it's not like
by Ray Stevens,
standard Ray Stevens.
This isn't as bad as some of his other track.
It definitely isn't, but I'm still skipping it. But 19 for you is Gladys Knight and the Pips with The Way We Were, Try to Remember.
I'm skipping this because it's just a cover of the Barbra Streisand song, although it does have a super duper long spoken word intro to it, which is like damn near half the song, but it's Gladys Knight singing The Way We Were. So it's pretty good, but it's, you know, nothing terribly interesting about it. So that moves us on to number 18, I'll Play For You by Seals and Crofts.
This is a skip for me.
Yes! I fucking hate this song. Oh, I hate this song.
I've never heard it before.
Oh, okay. It's probably, in a way, it's probably a shame that I didn't get this, because this song I used to hear a lot in this period, and it just, that was probably my first conception of, man, I hate this song. Even when I was like 4 years old, I was like, this is terrible.
Yeah, it's not that great.
No, it's awful. even by Seals and Crofts standards, it's like painfully terrible to listen to.
I hate it. Well, I'm glad I skipped it then, but it's number 17 for you, 10cc with I'm Not In Love.
Big boys don't cry. Big boys don't cry. Big boys don't cry.
Anyway, this is probably the definition. If like I use this adjective, probably overuse it, frankly, in like other stuff. I describe a lot of things as ethereal, which is like, you know, kind of like in the air, you know, lighter than air type stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know that there's another song that could be better described as ethereal than I'm Not In Love by 10cc. It has a ghostly backing track that was really difficult for them to record, actually. It was like Graham Goldman, Kevin Godley, and Lil Cream recorded 16 times each for each note of the chromatic scale to get that background, that part that's kind of ghosts in and out of the song throughout. The musical backing is very dissonant. Has that Cheddar, you know, Velveeta 70s synthesizer to it, which Billy Joel stole for Just the Way You Are later. But
right.
Probably, you know, definitely 10cc's probably best known song. While they still had their original group. I mean, they had the things we do for love after Godly and Cream left, but
Dreadlock Holiday
later on. But that wasn't really a hit. That was a hit in the UK. That wasn't really, it's better known now here, but that wasn't a hit here back then. Been used in a ton of movies because it's, you know, fits a certain mood. Probably the movie it's best known for, I think you'd agree with this, is Deuce Bigalow, Male Gigolo. I mean, okay. Who's going to argue with that?
Okay, yeah.
So, anyway, pretty cool song. And it's one of those songs, though, that was out in the mid-70s. And Dreamweaver, which was later, was another one that, as a kid, I was like, this is kind of scary. I don't really get this. You know, Dreamweaver definitely scared me when I was a kid. This one, I don't know if it scared. I don't remember this one scaring me, but it would have been, you would have heard all these songs kind of together on the radio at the time. And, you know, it was like, so there was this kind of movement of these kind of weird, sort of quietish experimental type songs, which didn't last very long. I mean, disco kind of wiped that out in the late 70s. So it's very specific of its time. But next up for you is One of These Nights at 16 by the Eagles.
And this is a change of course for them. It doesn't really sound like any of the singles that the band put out before this. Kind of almost soft rock meshed with R&B. Glenn Frey was listening
Little Disco, too.
Yeah, Little Disco also. Glenn Frey was listening to a lot of Al Green and the Spinners at the time. And they're also at the next door to the Bee Gees while they were recording Main Course. So that kind of rubbed off on the song as well. And it kind of has like a dark, sleazy vibe to it. And Henley's singing the lead, but he teams up with Randy Meisner on the chorus, kind of going into falsetto, and the chorus, probably a little bit of the Bee Gees influence there. But probably my pick for the best Eagles single. I don't know.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man, I'm going to fight you on that. I don't like this song.
Really?
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of One of These Nights.
Okay.
Because I don't know. It's too, it's not like it's terrible, but it's too disco-y for me. And I know they delved into that a little bit later on in the 70s, but to me, it just doesn't fit the Eagles. And I don't know.
Maybe that's why I like it the best.
Maybe. I don't know.
But it also has a pretty good guitar solo on it from new member Don Felder.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I've always liked this one.
Well, I don't, so you're wrong, and I'm right. But
okay, but 15 for you, Olivia Newton-John with Please, Mr. Please.
Well, I think in the wake of Grease and Xanadu and Let's Get Physical, you know, around the late 70s, early 80s, I think people forget that Olivia Newton-John started as a quasi-country artist. I mean, she had country hits in the mid-70s, and this song is one of them. It's country-ish. I wouldn't say it's not like she's down at a honky-tonk, you know, kicking shit with Jerry Jeff Walker or something like that. This is definitely commercial pop country, but this song is in that vein, and it peaked at number 3 on this chart, but it did reach number 5 on the country chart, too, and people also forget that Grease was sort of a comeback for Olivia Newton-John. I mean, this was actually her last hit on the top 40 until Grease came out. And that's a 3-year period. So, you know, she's often thought of as, you know, a consistent artist through the 70s. But, you know, her perception at this time was totally different than it would have been by the end of the 70s. And this is actually from the Have You Never Been Mellow album, which was released as a single before this was, which is one of the wonkiest song titles of all time.
It is.
Yeah. But also one of my earliest radio memories, because that song was on the radio all the time. I mean, and maybe that was mom rock because, you know, I don't know how much AM radio had split off into FM and all that by 75, but
yeah,
I do recall hearing this one. Or Have You Never Met Mellow quite a bit.
Huh.
Please, I remember hearing this one a lot too. But
yeah.
So number 14 for you, Matt, is Swearing to God by Frankie Valli. And this is a skip, kind of a reluctant skip, but just needed something to skip.
Fail.
Okay. But 13 for you is America with Sister Golden Hair. I can't say this for certain, but I think that every Time Life collection from the 70s includes the opening chords of this song somewhere in the, yes, in the commercial. It's like, bum, 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 and it's like, super sounds of the 70s. This is the stuff. You would have to buy 30 CDs to get all the things we have on one CD, like this. And I thought, thinking of you, sister.
Yeah.
So, anyway. The description of this, go if you want some good comedy, go listen to the Genesis of America songs, because they're like so banal, it's just ridiculous. Because they're a banal band, basically. I mean, they just are. But somehow, I'm not even going to describe it. It was inspired by Jackson Browne, which is himself banal. So,
okay.
But this was on the Hearts album by America, and the album cover was supposedly designed by Phil Hartman. Although, when I looked it up on Discogs, it says it wasn't. So, but okay. He did design some other America.
Their greatest hits album.
He designed their greatest hits album cover and a couple others. So maybe this was, maybe he just wasn't credited for it. I don't know. But a lot of people don't know that Phil Hartman, before he became a comedian and Saturday Night Live and all that, was a graphic artist.
Right.
So
yep.
That's what he did.
See, I've always liked this song, actually.
I shouldn't slag it. Actually, I don't mind this song either. And I don't mind Ventura Highway either. There's actually some good America songs, but they're one of those bands though that's like nobody is like a are there passionate America fans out there? I think there may have been in the 70s.
Yeah.
But they're like the Coldplay of American rock. I mean, they're just,
yeah,
they reliably make catchy music, some cringeworthy music as well. But it's not like it's groundbreaking, you know.
Right.
I mean, America's basically, like, this song basically is an Eagles ripoff, sort of, really.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah. I mean,
it sounds like a nicer version of Take It Easy.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that.
It has the same chord.
Yeah.
So, let's see. Number 12 is Only Women, I think it's Only Women Bleed, by Alice Cooper.
Okay. And yeah, the full title of this is Only Women Bleed, and it was changed to Only Women because of complaints from feminist groups. But they probably didn't actually listen to the song because it's actually attacking domestic violence. Basically, it's about a woman giving all that she can to a guy, and she just gets neglected and slapped around. And Alice is just kind of like saying only women have to deal with this, basically.
Yep.
And it was his first solo single, his first solo hit. And it was actually written by Dick Wagner, who was in his band and was in Lou Reed's band before this. And Alice kind of reworked it a little bit. And it was also controversial at the time, not just because of the title, well, actually because of the title, but it was misinterpreted as being about menstruation.
Right. That's what I actually thought it was about.
Yes. And the video kind of also drives that home a little bit because Alice is in like an all red background too. So just kind of like giving the visual of blood. But if I had to guess, it probably inspired Kiss to put out Beth about a year after this.
Because I'd rather not like guess about the conception of Beth.
Yeah, because it's like the first example of a hard rock artist doing like a sensitive ballad. So, but, okay. At number 11 here, we have the Doobie Brothers with Take Me in Your Arms, Rock Me.
This is a skip. This is a Motown cover, actually, of a pretty lesser known Motown song. But I can never... Once I've read about this song, it kind of makes sense now that I hear it, that they were literally trying to replicate Motown. They were doing their best to try to pay tribute to Motown. And okay, if I think of it as a Motown tribute, they did a pretty good job. I've never thought of it in that way though until I did this. And so I just thought it was kind of the Doobie Brothers, like mid-tempo Doobie Brothers. So
yeah,
but this is a skip. I've just never been able to get into this song.
Okay.
A song I do like that's kind of cool that you get is number 10, Cut the Cake by Average White Band.
Scottish funk.
Yes.
It's a funk jam. It's similar to their previous hit, Pick Up the Pieces, but there are a little bit more lyrics to it, but it's still almost like, I mean, almost more of an instrument than like just, I mean, there was really nothing to the lyrics. It's almost just cut the cake and gimme that cake just over and over.
Which means ass.
Yes, yes. But there is a coincidence between, they're at number 10 on this one, and there's a coincidence with of the artist that was at number 10 on our last episode, Tommy James of the Shondells. They both appeared in a Schlitz malt liquor commercial in 1981.
I remember that.
Tommy James is and his band, I'm assuming it's like none of the actual Shondells, but they walk in and they're like singing about how they're going to get an ice cold beer, and then Average White Band goes, "Bull!" And then they start.
The bull comes in?
No, that comes at the end. Oh. They start singing about Schlitz malt liquor, bull, and like how nobody beats the bull. And then Tommy James goes, "Look out!" And then the bull crashes through the wall.
That was high beer culture of the time.
Yes, but I mean, it was a year before Schlitz went bankrupt, so presumably they shelled out way too much money for Average White Band and Tommy James and the Shondells.
Yeah, having Average White Band in 1981 wouldn't have been very cool.
Yeah, yeah.
The Bull was cooler than Average White Band at that point.
Right, but I checked out a Soul Train performance of this, and these guys didn't really look that cool either. I mean, they're like the most Scottish-looking guys ever. They're playing funk on Soul Train, so it's kind of funny.
These guys were in, one time when I was in the flats in Cleveland, they were at one of the theaters down there, and I wanted to, that was really before I had a knowledge of funk, and so I was sort of laughing at their band name, but honestly, I probably should have gone in there and watched it.
Probably would have been decent. Yeah. I mean, this song's decent, Pick Up the Pieces is decent, so yeah.
They had a very specific way of playing funk guitar. It was really kind of tight and, you know, not very expansive, but it worked.
Yeah, definitely did. But anyway, let's move on to number 9 here, Pilot with Magic.
Well, we just had Average White Band, so Pilot is also from Scotland. In the 70s, may very well be the cultural zenith of Scotland in general. I mean, the Tartan Army was pumping out catchy shit in a bunch of different genres, like an assembly line. If you put a bagpipe in a song in the 70s, it was probably going to go to number one in the UK, at least, if not be a hit here. I mean, I'm thinking of like Amazing Grace, Mull of Kintyre had bagpipe in it.
Yeah.
And of course the Bay City Rollers from Scotland would emerge later on in 1975
yeah.
as like a sensation. And they were, as teen bands go, were pretty decent.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the primary members of Pilot, David Patton and Billy Lyall, were actually substitute members of the Bay City Rollers before they broke big. So, you know, Scotland isn't that big, so I'm sure they run in similar circles and all that.
Right.
But for whatever reason, Magic, among which was basically a one-hit wonder, at least here it was, this song has really endured. It's probably bigger now than it was in the mid-70s.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
It's been used in a bunch of Disney movies and TV shows. For one thing. And then it was sampled by Flo Rida about 10 years ago in a big hit song as well. So did you know that Flo Rida means Florida?
I did know that, actually. Wow. Yes.
That's amazing. There should be a rapper called Wisconsin. We were thinking about that today. Right? We were riding through rural Wisconsin.
Uh-huh.
Like, is there a highway OG anywhere?
There might be.
Or Highway MF.
I doubt an MF. I think they would have caught that, but there might be an OG out there.
There's got to be an OG out in Wisconsin somewhere. If somebody knows that, let us know.
Right.
There's all kinds of cool, like,
letter accommodations.
I'll bet there's an AF out there.
I'm pretty sure there is.
I used to live on Highway KB. for whatever that's worth.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, number eight is Get Down, Get Down, Get on the Floor by Joe Simon.
And this is funk, early disco, kind of boogie jam. Have we counted, like, how many times the words get down pop up on, like, on this chart? Because it has to be just a ton.
You mean in the lyrics of the songs?
Yeah, yeah.
No, I haven't been keeping track.
Yeah, me neither. But, I mean, at least on my side of the chart, most of them have. But anyway, this also mentions Kung Fu Bumpin' a lot in the lyrics, which I'm almost 100% sure is a reference to Kung Fu Fighting.
Yeah.
But Joe Simon sounds very similar to Bobby Womack. He initially got his start in gospel, and Sam Cooke, listening to Sam Cooke kind of inspired him to move to R&B in the early 60s. And he actually ended up going back into gospel a few years after this and started his own church in Chicago. So kind of going the same route as Al Green. But this was his biggest hit. This was its peak on the chart, number one R&B. And it was also his last top 40. But he still kind of kept going in gospel throughout the 80s. So,
yeah,
wasn't goodbye for good for him. But anyway, let's
move. Goodbye to him for now.
Yes. Yes, it is. But number seven for you is Wings with Listen to What the Man Said.
Who is the man in this song title? I don't even know. But this song was recorded in New Orleans. And like a lot of McCartney liked recording in different places. Like he recorded Band on the Run in Nigeria rather randomly.
Yeah.
You'd never know it by listening to it. And this song is sort of like that too. I mean, outside of maybe the 70s sax that's in it, that sort of suggests New Orleans, and they did hire a New Orleans session guy to do it. It's not like you listen to What the Man Said and you go, man, McCartney's in New Orleans. It doesn't sound like that at all. So I'm not sure why he went through the process of doing stuff like that, but it's a good song though. Like most Wing songs, it's catchy as hell. It's from Venus and Mars, which I think is probably, you could make the art, it's probably the best Wings album. I think it might be, Band on the Run is pretty good. I suppose you could make an equally good argument for that album, but this is another song that was pretty ubiquitous at the time. And, you know, just has a good driving, it's driving, but it's still a mid-tempo song. Like you could hear it on a soft rock station and it wouldn't be out of place. So,
right.
But McCartney was on a roll. He would have Silly Love Songs a year later, and Band on the Run, of course, came about a year before this. So really in his solo career, this period was probably his peak, like right in the mid 70s, where both artistically and popular and in a popular sense, not that he was ever unpopular, but, so this was a good time to be Paul McCartney. Probably he was definitely king of the Beatles solo artists at this point. I don't think there's any question about that.
Definitely. Yeah.
They kind of traded off. Like for George Harrison started out as number one, then John Lennon took over for a brief period, and then Paul McCartney. I don't think Ringo ever got in the mix, but
well, Ringo is always kind of always around. I mean, he always had like a single out.
Yeah, he did, but I don't think he ever overtook the artistic, you know, credibility or popularity of the other three at any point. And even George Harrison's run was pretty brief in that respect too, but
yeah, that's true.
So anyway, number six for you, The Hustle by Van McCoy and the Soul City Symphony.
I've always thought that this song sounds like the Showcase Showdown music from Price is Right.
Okay, go ahead.
You know how like they're showing like trip to Aruba,
yeah,
like new car and stuff like that, and then you have to bid on it.
Yeah
So that's, I mean,
the only music I can think of with Price is Right now is that, other than the loser horn, is the da 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 da.
That's the theme song.
Yeah, no, but there's like different versions of it though.
Okay,
I'm thinking of when they play the show out at the end. That's okay.
In my head for some reason.
Right. But it's inspired by the dance, The Hustle, and there's actually different variations of The Hustle. The original version was called The Latin Hustle, and it was created by Puerto Rican teens in the South Bronx, and it was more or less a partners or a couples dance. And there was also a line dance variation, which came out later, and this was what actually inspired McCoy to write the song about The Hustle. He saw people doing the dance, so he figured he'd just write a song about it. And most of the dancing in Saturday Night Fever is just variations of The Hustle. On the poster where Travolta is doing the pointing in the air, that's a move in the line dance version of The Hustle. So, but this was Van McCoy's only hit as a solo artist. He's part of a not-so-exclusive group of people who had their only top 40 hit go to number one. And I wanted to list some of them, but, I mean, there's just so many. Just in the mid-70s, you had Paper Lace, Carl Douglas, Billy Swan, Minnie Riperton, the Starland Vocal Band, Wild Cherry, Walter Murphy, and Rick Dees. I just wanted to throw Rick Dees in there.
That sounds like the end of the Sgt. Pepper movie, like where they have all the celebrities, quote unquote,
yes,
at the end. That's what that sounds like. Yeah.
But as a songwriter prior to this, he had more hits. One of them was actually in last episode that he wrote for the Marvelettes. Yep. But he wrote for Gladys Knight, David Ruffin as a solo artist. So, but this was his only hit as a solo artist, but it's pretty, I mean, kind of started off disco. This could probably be considered like the very first disco hit.
I think some people do consider it to be one. I don't know that it actually is, but it's a pretty great song. I always thought this one was cool.
Yeah, it's, I mean, pretty memorable. Pretty memorable.
Do it. Do it.
This is another one that sounds dense, too. I don't know that it was recorded in Miami, but it also has that sound to it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. With the strings and the horns and stuff like that. Yeah. But great song. And he also put together Peaches and Herb. So he has that going for him, too.
Yep. So do I.
It's number five for you, Major Harris with Love Won't Let Me Wait.
Well, this is kind of just cool, melly, Philly soul. Major Harris was in the Delphonics before this and after this, actually. This was his only top 40 solo hit. But this song, more importantly, is part of the slow progression of female sexual audio in songs. So
yes,
you're going from, you're near the top, because you're really just the only, and the DEFCON grade of female orgasm in song, you're at like DEFCON 2, mm-hmm. where DEFCON 1 would be Love to Love You Baby by Donna Summer, which came out a little later. Yeah. But this one's pretty close. I think the radio cuts off most of this, because I heard the full version when I was researching this, and I'm like, there's a little bit of that in the radio version, but then you listen to the album version, and it's like, whoa, okay. I guess they just didn't turn off the audio on that. So, yeah, it's kind of explicit as they get down to business.
Yes, yes, yes.
So, yeah. So this is a song you put on when you're with your lady, I guess.
Yeah, definitely.
So, number four for you, on a totally different vein, is I'm Not Lisa by Jesse Coulter.
And this is a country ballad. It was written by Coulter. Written from a perspective of a girlfriend whose boyfriend can't get over his ex. The ex's name's Lisa. She's Julie in the song. And she's kind of like saying that she won't dump you like Lisa did. And I'm assuming it was probably inspired by Coulter's real life husband, Waylon Jennings, having his own Lisa. Just kind of a guess there, but
probably.
But this was her only hit that crossed over onto the pop charts. This was its peak on the chart, number one on the country charts. And you kind of alluded to
Charlie Rich burning John Denver's like
CMA envelope.
Yeah, and actually this was nominated for best song at the CMA Awards and it lost to John Denver.
Well, see, Waylon Jennings could have burned one too.
Yeah, he could have. But I mean presumably Waylon was like drunk in a bathroom at the time.
Don't be dissing on Waylon, okay?
I know, but that's probably
not drunk. He's probably whacked out on cocaine or something like that.
Probably.
I'm a big Jesse Coulter fan. This is not one of my favorite songs by her because it's really maudlin, but when she decided to belt one out like a fast tempo song, she's as good as anybody.
Oh yeah, definitely. So, definitely.
Yeah, but it's a shame that none of those songs are better known, but she's legit outlaw country-ish type female artist.
Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. And obviously, the Outlaws album became a huge hit like a year after this, too.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, number three for you, Michael Murphy with Wildfire.
Yep. And in the most inevitable thing ever, there's a YouTube video with horses running around and cheesy horse paintings featured in the video for. What is the deal with cheesy horse paintings?
I don't know. Like any town
that has like antique shops or boutiques and stuff like that. There's usually some wing devoted to a bunch of like all those kind of glass blown type of paintings with horses on it running around. It's like, who buys that shit? But
yeah,
this song is like the oral version of those songs. Cause I mean, the song is about a stupid horse who escapes his stall and he causes the death of his female owner in a snowstorm when she goes out to look for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so somehow the spirit of the woman enters an owl or a hoot owl, as Michael Martin Murphy decided to describe it. And it lands on the windowsill or whatever of her, presumably her lover or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, and it inspires the boyfriend to want to ride Wildfire, the horse, with her in the great beyond. So it's a song of longing. But maybe it's a metaphor for hell. I mean, the horse is called Wildfire. It leads two different people to oblivion based on their worldly desires. So maybe Michael Martin Murphy was going for something a little darker here, though. Nobody really
could be. Could be.
Or not. Or maybe he just made a really bizarro song that somehow managed to hit the right buttons in 1975. I don't know. I do remember hearing this song a lot. I actually don't mind the guitar in it. It does have that kind of, it has a unique guitar sound to it, but
yeah,
you know, or, I don't know. Maybe it's just about a horse. Maybe it's just as simple as that. It's a stupid name for a horse. Wildfire.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's dumber names for horses.
I named my horse Secretary.
Just so I think that one's taken already.
I have a lot to live up to.
I had a horse. Secretariat Junior.
Just Secretariat. I wouldn't even have it. Or I'd just name him Gus.
Gus. Yeah.
I'd have to
emulate the mule from the Don Knotts movie.
No, it would just stand on its own. It would just be Gus the horse.
Okay.
But so this was a big hit. Michael Martin Murphy is still around. In fact, he played Terre Haute not too long ago.
Really?
Huh. But this was his big hit. So
yes,
you know, it is what it is.
Right.
Number two for you is When Will I Be Loved by Linda Ronstadt.
And this is an Everly Brothers cover. Linda's version she kind of transposes the verses around a little bit, but otherwise it's pretty faithful to the song. It's just kind of a mid-70s update of the song, and it's one of her better singles, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I've always really liked this one.
It rocks.
Yeah, it does. And like most of her songs, she is basically backed up by the same band. And Andrew Gold actually plays guitar on the track, later went on to have a big hit with Lonely Boy.
And the Golden Girls theme.
Yes. He wrote the original version, or wrote and performed the original version of that.
Yep.
But Linda's version did do better on the charts than the Everly Brothers version. Their version only made it to number 8. Hers kind of stalled at number 2 here, but it was a number 1 country hit, which I was kind of surprised about.
And the B-side of this also charted. The B-side was It Doesn't Matter Anymore. But it was kept off the top by our number one song.
Uh-oh. Segue.
Yes, yes. So here we go. Number one is Love Will Keep Us Together by Captain and Tennille.
This song was written by Neil Sedaka, but I have to hand it to Daryl Dragon, the captain. Because there are some catchy backing keys and bass on this song, which kind of make it what it is. Because it does, this song is a little bit funky at times.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm probably I'm stretching funk.
The clavinet on it.
There's clavinet on it. The bass is good on it too. I'm definitely stretching the definition of funk. But for some reason, the 45 cover has Captain Tennille posing with a pair of bulldogs. It was the 70s.
Yeah, maybe they're...
I don't get it.
They're dogs.
What's the weirdest thing about to me about this song is that Joy Division's Love Will Tear Us Apart is an answer song to this.
Really? Yeah. Really?
That's bizarre. I mean, I have to question whether that's real or not. But this was the number one overall song of 1975, period. So This is yet another song that was... definitely, I remember it was on the radio a lot, and I think we may have even had this album if I remember
right. I think we did, yeah.
But it was number one on both Billboard and Cashbox, and it's the 259th biggest hit of all time,
really,
since 1958. So, just a happy, peppy 1975 song by Captain and Tennille. Standards are not very horny on this song, So. They saved that for their other stuff, for Muskrat Love.
Yes, which is about muskrats doing it.
Yeah, which, why wouldn't you want to hear about that?
Right.
Did they get actual audio of muskrats boning for that?
No, it's just like weird, like, sense noises.
Maybe that's the noise they make, though.
Could be. I've never really listened to a muskrat before.
Well, they let you know what the mating call of a muskrat is. The Captain and Tennille are educational.
Exactly. Yeah.
Anyway, that's it.
Yeah.
So, what do we got next week?
Let's see. Well, I'm going a little bit out of our comfort zone here.
Uh-oh. Okay.
We're going to the dead era of the early 60s.
Oh, boy. Okay. What is it?
We're going to July 6th, 1963.
Okay.
And there's a lot of familiar songs on this. Surf rock was kind of big at the time, but this era has always been maligned, and I just wanted to explore it.
Okay. That's fair.
Yeah.
So are we going to have any, is Telstar on this?
No. There is a very famous instrumental on this, though. It's actually on your side of the list, too.
Is Doin' Da Butt by EU on this?
No, but it should be. Okay. It should be. They should have traveled in time.
I guess I got my time periods mixed up. All right. Sounds good.
Okay.
All right. Good to do this in person.
Yeah.
We'll be back next week with bad audio glitches and remote issues.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
We're not going to have any blarred out voices on this one. It's a shame. That's kind of the character of the podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
The voices once in a while go wonk.
Yeah, it's kind of a trademark.
But all right, thanks for listening.
Yeah, see you next week, everybody.
Are you coming in, or are you going to piss about all day?
You're bloody finished, you know that, Jack. I've bloody finished you.